makes me angry, frustrated, disappointed that there are people that are actually working against what we feel is a cause that would save humanity in the future. So I guess we will wait to see the outcome of this meeting, and it's not over yet. So hopefully we get some positives out of this the outcome of this meeting in Dubai.
I know that you're not there at COP, but there has been reporting that in a closed-door meeting of key ministers convened by the COP president, that Australia's made some, Chris Bowen, the climate minister's made some very strong cases and arguments for, like the EU, phase out fossil fuel. And so that language is very much in line with what you and the other Pacific leaders are calling for. How do you react to, the stronger language we've seen on that? Australia is a large exporter of fossil fuels. It's been a part of tangled in our climate change policies for many years.
No, that's welcoming news for us to hear Australia making that commitment. As you said, Australia is one of the bigger exporters of fossil fuels. So it means a lot when it's coming from Australia that they're serious about phasing out on the use of fossil fuels. And it's very pleasing for us as well to have Australia. We always look at Australia as a bigger brother. And it's always good to have them in our corner, especially in this sorts of forum. So that's very welcoming news for us.
Your video, standing knee high in that water, really painted that visual picture. I mean, there is a lot on the line for Tuvalu, for the residents of Tuvalu. Can you explain how critical it is that you're watching this very closely, that we get the right outcome here?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot at stake for Tuvalu. Overshooting 1.5 means that countries like Tuvalu will be fully submerged by the oceans within a number of decades. So it is an existential threat for Tuvalu and countries like Tuvalu. And it is quite sad that countries can't make the right decisions to save countries like Tuvalu. And we always like to say that if you save Tuvalu, you're essentially saving the world, because the climate crisis does not only affect Tuvalu, it affects everyone. And we're seeing that in the form of bushfires and floods and droughts in different parts of the world. And my hope is just that that the world gets its act together before we pass the tipping point.
Your Prime Minister, Tuvalu Prime Minister's addressed COP as well, and he says he wants this to be the COP of hope. I mean, is hope running low at the moment, considering what we've just spoken about?
Well, we always try to be optimistic when we are sending our team to negotiate and to push for stronger climate action from the bigger countries. But I think if we look back in history and the many COPs that we've had over the years, I'm not too sure whether we can actually achieve this, because it's one thing to make these commitments and pledges, and it's something else to actually implement it. So if it's so difficult to even just agree on language, you can imagine what it's going to look like when it comes to implementation. I mean, there are pledges that have already been made at COP, and countries have still not implemented those commitments. So I think there's, hope, but I think that as time ticks, I think that hope diminishes.
We did hear even on day one, loss and damage fund announced. This has been something that nations like Tuvalu and small island nation states have called for more than 30 years. What's been your reaction to that? I mean, obviously there are lots of problems with implementation, but was that a breakthrough to see that that kind of operationalised and some pledged or funding put forward, even though Australia hasn't put any funding yet into that?
I think it's a movement in the right direction. Obviously, there's still a lot of work to be done for countries like Tuvalu to actually see the benefits of this financing mechanism. But I do want to congratulate our negotiators from last year and even at this COP to really get this financing facility up and running. Obviously, the basis of this fund is polluter has to pay, and that's really the basis of why we're advocating for this. It's it's a matter of justice. Countries that have enriched themselves by destroying the environment have a responsibility to compensate.
When we look at the disparity, I'm reading that it's 0.03%. That's the emissions footprint that the whole Pacific Island region has. Yet there, you're literally on the front line. Can you describe how that, you know, how that is in terms of that's what you mean when you talk about climate justice?
Yeah, I mean we're contributing very little to the problem, yet we are facing the full brunt of the impacts of climate change. But I think it places countries like Tuvalu in a very strong moral position to be able to make these demands on the international stage. And it's not calling for countries to help little countries. It's a matter of justice. But the polluter has to pay the message that are pushing for on the international stage, and we're hoping that it really translates into benefits for countries like Tuvalu.
In terms of the details of the fund, that's still yet to be worked out. There's been strong calls by advocates to make sure it includes economic and non-economic loss and damage, including aspects of culture. What are your thoughts on making sure that the culture aspect is also included in any loss and damage fund?
Yeah, I mean, for countries like Tuvalu, the impacts of climate change could force our whole population to relocate. And that has an impact on, I mean, psychologically, it separates us from our land. And there's a lot of culture that is connected to our physical territory and also our ocean. And so it's very important when we're talking about loss and damage, it's not just the loss of what is in the physical. It's also the memory and the heritage and the culture that is connected to the land. And I fully support that assertion that has to be included in the negotiations.
What about the fact that Australia has not pledged any funding towards this loss and damage, even though it's rejoined the Green Climate Fund and put forward foundational funding for the Pacific Resilience Financing Facility? What do you make of the fact that Australia hasn't put any funding forward on the Loss and Damage Fund? Is that critical that needs to happen?
Yeah, I think Australia needs to really consider its actions, because they are asking to host a COP in the future. And I think if they're really serious about taking leadership, then they need to walk the talk. And I guess all we can do from our side is remind them, encourage Australia. Australia is a very close development partner for Tuvalu, but it doesn't stop us from standing up and talking to our friends.
What do you make of Australia's, kind of changed posture towards climate change since the Albanese government came into play? The Pacific Islands Forum, there was announced the bilateral treaty between Tuvalu and Australia, opening the pathway for 280 Tuvaluans a year to start with, to live, work, study here as a result of the climate change impacts. I've been reading that you want that deal renegotiated. What are your concerns?
Right, well, I think there are some improvements that can be made. I've noted one specific area is the access that Australia will have to our immigration, citizenship, and passport systems and processes. So that's concerning, because I don't know of any other country in the world, independent country, that would give that level of access to another country. So that's an area that is of concern. The other is found in Article 4.4 of the treaty, which requires Tuvalu to seek the approval of Australia. And security has quite a broad definition under the treaty. It covers communications, maritime. So that's a concern for us, because that does take away the freedom of Tuvalu to make its own decisions. Now we're subject to a veto power by Australia. So those are things that need to be worked out, and I think the new government will need to look into that.
It's not the ideal scenario. We want the land to be there, but in terms of, I guess, the seeing it before your eyes, a personal reflection from you, I mean, to see how the land has changed in the years that we've seen since that viral video, even before in your lifetime, your home being swallowed up by rising seawater?
Yeah, I think it's a way of presenting our story to the world. I travel a bit to some of these bigger countries and big cities, and many of the people I talk to in those big cities, they can't imagine, you know, living on a thin strip of island in the middle of the ocean. I think for us, we need to package our message in such a way that it appeals to the people and it gives them that understanding to feel what it's like to be in our shoes. And part of the, this project, this Future Now project, where we're looking at statehood and digital nation, there's a message in that to the people as well, to see that a country is actually preparing for a worst case scenario. And we're hoping that also appeals to the wider population.
This idea of climate change refugees, I mean, it's not something you necessarily want to take up coming to Australia, because then that would mean the death of your home.
That's correct. And we've been very careful in how we advocate relocation, because relocation can be used against us. Australia could say, well, we can take all 10,000 of you in Australia. But that doesn't really fix the problem of the climate change and the climate crisis that we're facing. And it has a huge impact on the people having to leave their land.